This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the April 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is The Thunderer by Alan Dean Foster. Out southwest of New Orleans, there are places in parishes with names like Iberia and Cameron, Vermilion and Terrebonne, where sometimes even the rain has no ambition. Instead of falling hard and quicksilver, it just sort of dribbles down out of a winter sky, the color of soiled mattresses. By the time it's worked its lazy way through the obstructing leaves and bushes and Spanish moss, you can almost hear it sigh in relief as it finally touches ground. The Texan geologist tugged the slick bill of her rain cap lower over her forehead, and still the rain crawled for her eyes. "You sure that place is around here, Crossett?" "Yes, ma'am." The guide grinned. His narrow face erupted with alternating squares of ivory and gold, a thin parody of a Vasarely print. His hand, which always shook slightly, was an extension of the outboard motor. Voice of man and voice of motor were also much alike. Steady, unexcited purrs. "Jean Pearl's been living here since before I was born," he added conversationally, peering to one side to see ahead. "Nobody around here knows who come first, Jean Pearl or Jean Pearl's cabin." May Watkins looked back at him. "Since before you were born?" The geologist giggled, an infectious cotton candy sound that shoved aside the somberness of the rain-sogged swamp. "He must be old, then." "Nobody knows, ma'am." Crossett leaned affectionately on the motor's arm, and the boat swung slightly to starboard. The trees closed wooden arms above. Watkins felt as though they were sliding weightlessly down a gray-green tunnel. The world here was composed of gray permutations, swamp colors, homogenized by the storm. Trees were gray-green and gray-brown, the occasional heron white-gray, and gators and anhingas so gray as to be rendered invisible. Gray moss drifted on gray water. There was a click forward, and she turned her attention to her assistant. "Lay off, Carrie. You know how the company feels about shooting for sport." The other geologist was barely into his 30s and less out of childhood. Reluctantly, he slipped the safety back on and set the rifle across his knee. "May, he was a 20-footer if he was an inch." "Africa's 10,000 miles away, Carrie," she nodded to her right. "You're a goddamn geologist, not Frank Buck." "Frank who?" "Before your time." He still looked disgusted. "Nobody had to know. I had a clean shot." "I'd know." She let that percolate, then added, "If this trip pans out and we can confirm the hopes of the aerial survey, the company will buy you your own pool of gators and you can indulge yourself in an orgy of slaughter." Seeing his glum look, she said, less accusingly, "And when you do, I want at least 3 pairs of shoes, different styles, and bags to match." He tried hard not to smile and failed. Flustered, he turned away, scanning the nebulous line dividing island from water. It was hard to stay mad around May Watkins. No matter that she was 15 years his senior and his superior on this trip, anyone who could switch from boss to mother to coquette in the same sentence kept you eternally off balance. Anyhow, he consoled himself, there was always a chance a gator might charge them. Held tight in his palms, the wood of the rifle was hard and warm, slick, comfortable. Crossett saw the geologist's fingers tighten around the gun and smiled. He could sense what the younger man was thinking. on the bizarre happenstance that some crazy gator did burst out of the water nearby, that fool white boy was more likely to blow off his own foot than anything else. Though, in weather like this, one couldn't discount superiors. His own rifle lay near his feet. It was nicked and worn, and the barrel wrapped with steel tape to hold it together. No matter, what counted was where the bullet ended up, not what it emerged from. Rain tickled his eyebrows. Fog and drizzle teased his vision. "There she be, ma'am, just like I said." "Yes, Crossett, just like you said." She arranged equipment, poking into the lockers set below the seats. The photos and charts she ignored. The rain wouldn't hurt them. They'd been laminated before setting out from Styrene 3 days ago. Carrie Briscoe set his rifle down and sniffed resignedly as they neared the island. The shack, drawing closer, resembled the exoskeleton of a long dead bug whose innards had long since decayed and putrefied, leaving only a shell behind. Dozens of sheet metal and tin roofing scraps covered the roof, a quilt held together with nails instead of thread. Two faded windows flanked the center door, rectangular eyes bordering a sagging nose. A front porch sagged alarmingly in odd places. There were no signs, not on the building, not on the collapsing jetty that thrust out into the bayou. They slid neatly up to the tiny pier, bumping against frayed eye sockets of old tires. "Watch your step, folks." Crossett was looping a line around a splintery piling. "Jetty's kind of worn." Worn, hell. Like a kid testing a hot bath, Briscoe gingerly put one foot, then the other, onto the first planks. He gave Watkins a hand up, then studied the cabin. "How does he make a living here? Whom can he sell to?" "Trappers, mostly." Crossett was lugging two large gas cans out of the back of the boat. They clanged noisily against each other, fruity echoes of distant thunder. "No roads out this way, but the swamp folk, they know he's here." They slogged towards the cabin. Interesting old structure. Watkins somehow found beauty, even in the dump they were approaching. To her, it was picturesque. To anyone else, it was a slum. Semantics, mused Briscoe. "As to why it and its owner are here, that's obvious," she said cheerily. "The man likes his privacy. Suppose he ran a store in a big town like Lafayette. What would he do with the extra money? Buy a private place out here in the woods and have to commute." "Very funny." Briscoe gave her a sour look as they stepped up onto the porch out of the rain. There was a dog there, lying against the house, probably supporting it, he thought. The shaggy lump was an amalgam of all dogs, a few Weltberger of pooches, a canine compendium of all the breeds of all the lands and ages, a mutt. There was little difference between its coat and the moss dangling from nearby live oak branches. At their arrival, it raised its head and surveyed them with a practiced eye, then dropped to the porch again. It did not let its head down. It literally dropped, landing with a distinctive thump. Crossett moved to knock. The door opened before he could. Standing in the portal was either the most Gallic black man or blackest Frenchman Watkins had ever seen. Also, the oldest. It was fitting that he was all of a tricolor. Hair, mustache, teeth, and eyes were white. Skin was black blue like ink, and in keeping with the day's coloring, his clothes were gray. He was slightly bent at the waist, but seemed alert and lively. Not at all like the ancient wreck she'd expected from Crossett's description. "Hello, Charlie Crossett." His voice was husky, but not cracked. "Jean Pearl." Their guide nodded minutely and held up the two cans. Gasp. Yep. Conversation hereabouts, Watkins mused, was as muted as the scenery. I'll get it for you. The old man took up the two cans and retreated inside, closing the door behind him. Friendly sort, said Briscoe, meaning the opposite. He stores his gasoline inside his house? In back. Crossett picked his teeth with a piece of porch. Oh, Jean Pearl, he friendly enough. A rodent of indeterminate pedigree scampered into view and Crossett spat at it. Like the lady say, he just liked his privacy. He also liked to take his time. While they waited, Watkins and Briscoe passed the minutes discussing articlines and salt domes. Around them, the rain intensified. A really worthwhile storm unfolded, droplets hammering the rich earth with liquid persistence. Eventually, the door was pulled inward and Pearl reemerged. He handed the filled cans to Crossett. Going back now, I expect? The query was unexpected. No, Jean Pearl, these folks down from Styrene, oil people. Huh, know-it-alls. Watkins smiled at him. I suppose you don't think much of us, do you, tearing up your beautiful swamps with our rigs? Pearl surprised her by responding with a wheezing chuckle. You crazy fool people. What I care about, swamp, you go tear up all you want. Don't you like it here? Briscoe was unable to resolve the statement with Crossett's insistence that Pearl loved his privacy. Like it? Like the swamp? Like copperheads and water moccasins, gators and rats and skeeters big as your little finger? You crazy for sure, boy, he shrugged. But what John Pearl to do? I born here. I live here too much my life. For sure I gonna die here. I got no place else I know, no place else to go. Like it? Boy, you want to tear up the swamp? You got Jean Pearl his blessings. Abruptly, his attitude changed drastically. But not round here, not tonight, yes? His voice had turned solemn, anxious, instead of challenging. You good fella, Charlie, he told their guide. I know your family from when four you born. I know your mama and papa. He gestured callously at the two geologists, speaking as though they weren't there. These folk, I don't know. I don't care. But you, pretty good guy. You go back northeast, Charlie. You don't go west. You don't go south, I tell you. The Thunderer, he out on night like it's for sure. You a good man yourself, Jean Pearl. Crossett regarded the oldster affectionately. We thank you for your warning, but we have to see to our business. Warning? Briscoe braced and looked interested. So did Watkins. What's this Thunderer he's talking about, Crossett? Their guide looked embarrassed. Pay him no mind, ma'am. It's an old Lucal's folk superstition, country tale. The Cajuns, they claim they get it from the Indians who hear first, and everyone else get it from the Cajuns. His smile returned. The Cajuns, they great storytellers. It make a nice tale to scare the children with during a fry or when everybody out frog-gigging. I'm always interested in folk legends. Watkins looked kindly at the recluse. What's a Thunderer, Mr. Pearl? You old people, you should know, Pearl snorted. The Thunderer, he made you oil for you. Briscoe struggled not to laugh. With all due respect, sir, petroleum is formed when decomposing organic matter is subjected to tremendous heat and pressure. Nobody makes it. You smart boy, you. Old Jean Pearl, he can't fool you. Pearl waggled a wrinkled finger at him. You find Thunderer, maybe then you find some oil. Yes. In that case, he's just the chap we'd like to meet, said Briscoe gently. What is he supposed to be like? Unobtrusively, Watkins had pulled out a pen and was fishing in her diary for a blank page. Not supposed, is. Excuse me, what is he like? Not for me to say, the Thunderer. He shy fella, Stay asleep under swamp all time, except few nights every year like this one. He big round as cypress, have biggest gator in swamp for toothpick, like to drink oil, and when he can't find it, he make it. Having lost interest, a bored Briscoe had turned away and was studying a chart. I see, Watkins' pen squiggled on the page she'd opened to. She finished jotting, then looked up. He's sort of a local Bigfoot, a southern Sasquatch, like a big hairy man, is he? You smart oil people, I can't hide nothing from you. He stared imploringly at Crossed. I can't stop you going, Charlie, I see that. You been in city too long much, you forget you mama's talk. No, John Pearl, Crossed spoke softly, humoringly. I haven't forgotten her or Papa either. I haven't forgotten they had nothing, and that I got a boat, and will soon have a new one, and a new gun, for helping these folks in their work. I don't forget easy, man. Thanks for your concerns. Pearl turned away and looked so distraught that Watkins was moved to reassure him. Don't worry about us, Mr. Pearl. We're armed, and Carrie here's a pretty good shot, just as I'm certain Mr. Crossed is. We'll be okay. You have trouble, Pearl replied firmly. You fire 3 times. If I hear Lightning and me, and he indicated the dog, which might have twitched at the mention of its name and might have not, we send for help. That's very gracious of you, she said. How much do I owe you for the gas? She had her wallet out. 4 gallon and 10th, only $5. John Pearl, the old man glanced angrily at Crossed. I take back what I say about you being good folk, Charlie. Mira blue. $4, then. The geologist pulled a damp 5 from her billfold. Here, keep it, for your concern. She noticed Crossed's disapproving look, but did not react. Back in the boat, slipping the line from the piling, Crossed said admonishingly, You shouldn't do that. Why not? She settled herself back on the outboard center seat. He looked like he could use the money, and Texan can afford it, even if we don't find any oil. It not that. Crossed got the engine started and headed them out into the bayou. Now he always think he put one over on you. No, I don't mind, she said easily. His concern for us was touching, even if misplaced. Bigfoots, snorted Briscoe. He spat out warm rainwater. Let's check out these coordinates, plant our charges, take our readings, and get the hell back to Styrene. I feel like I'll never be dry again. They did not reach the place marked on their charts that night. As they turned to land on High Island, the wind picked up, moaning through the trees and moss, making the swamp sound like the recreation room of an asylum. Rain blew sideways, sneaking around inside their hoods to crawl wetly down ears and necks. What do you think, Crossed? Watkins peered out of the pop tent at the sky as the guide jogged back up from their beached boat, a locker under each arm. I think it plenty damn wet, ma'am. He handed her the lockers one at a time, then slipped inside the tent, a roll of thunder on his heels. I think we should make supper and listen to the radio. As she spooned in her meal, Watkins reflected that advances in science still hadn't found a way to make freeze-dried food taste like food. It was tasty, even spicy, but it was the taste of spiced cardboard. She put aside the tin of macaroni and tuna and fiddled with the dial of the radio until she'd located the marine weather band. Tropical storm, she announced eventually, echoing the now silent broadcaster. She nudged the radio into a corner. Not a hurricane, not yet. And it's moving west. Ought to miss us by plenty, even if it should develop into something. She eyed Crossed. What's your opinion? He considered briefly. I think we only in danger of getting mighty soaked. You want to stay and work? I stay too. I didn't ask for acquiescence, Crossett. I asked what you thought. You know this country better than we do. I've been through two hurricanes for Texan, one at Styrene and one at Maracaibo. That's enough. I give you my honest opinion, ma'am. I think we'd be okay. Good. Briscoe was sopping up the remainder of his cheese sauce with a biscuit. Watkins winced as she watched him. He actually seemed to enjoy the stuff. I'd hate to motor back to town and have to tell them we wasted over a week of company time. That's settled, then. We stay. Carrie, see if you can find something interesting on the radio. He nodded, set down his scoured plate, and pulled over the unit. Anything in particular you'd like to hear? She leaned back into her bedroll. Beethoven or Bee Gees, it doesn't matter to me. The wind continued to howl incoherently around them, battering fitfully at the nylon walls of the tent. It shrugged off all attempts to force entry. The tubular aluminum frame forming a snug, secure dome overhead. Their weight kept it tight against the ground. Watkins found herself awake and turned her head sluggishly. A figure was moving about inside the tent. Carrie? No, ma'am, it me, came the deeper whisper. Oh, Crossett. She let her head flop down on the pillow and irritatedly adjusted her hairnet. What's up? I afraid the water rising, ma'am. Oh, we okay way up here in the trees, but I want to make sure of our boat. Good. Be sure and snap the flap on your way out, will you? You stay nice and dry, ma'am. I'll be careful. She had a brief glimpse of gray in motion. The thrumming of rain and wind was momentarily louder as the guide slipped out through the flap. She heard the flap snap catch behind him and lay back down. What's going on? Briscoe's blanket muffled voice. Crossett, gone to check out the boat. Shut up and go back to sleep. She found herself unable to return only halfway to the relaxing oblivion of sleep. The uneven ground seemed to bother her more now than when she'd first lain down, and she tossed and turned restlessly. Suddenly, she discovered herself sitting straight up, wide awake in that occasionally unreal fashion that strikes without warning. She looked around. The tent was unchanged. Outside, rain continued to pummel the earth. It sounded as though the wind had dropped slightly. Carrie, Carrie, she whispered insistently. Wake up, man. Huh? Something wrong? What time did Crossett go out? Briscoe was rubbing his eyes. He yawned. How the hell should I know? He went out? To check on the boat, remember? Oh, yeah, yeah. He glanced idly towards the third bedroll. It was empty. Not back yet, huh? He looked vaguely puzzled. No, she had a thought, fumbled through her bag and extricated her billfold. In the near blackness, she had to feel for the bills and credit cards. Everything seemed to be there. She wasn't embarrassed either by the thought of her actions in following it up. After all, she was a child of the city, not the country. Maybe he's having trouble with the boat, Briscoe suggested. She shook her head impatiently. I'll bet it's been at least an hour. Rolling over, she unlatched the tent flap and looked out into driving rain. Nothing. A flash of lightning revealed the outboard securely beached and tied to a cypress stump, but no Crossett. The lightning faded, leaving blue patches on her retinas. Thunder skipped like a stone across her ears. She let the flap fall and didn't bother to secure it. Well, now awake, Briscoe was sitting up on his foam pad and staring at her. She shook her head negatively and chewed her lower lip. Don't look so damn solemn, he advised her. Probably he wandered off somewhere, maybe looking for a better place to tie the boat up. Want some coffee, long as we're awake? He leaned on one side and began hunting in the darkness for the lantern. Uh-uh, thanks. Crossett would have come back and told us if he were going to be gone this long. A glow filled the tent as Briscoe got the Coleman going. Not necessarily. Polite as he is, he might not want to wake us. It could be, though, that he hurt himself. Easy to slip out in that muck. He sounded sympathetic and disgusted all at once. I don't relish going out looking for him. I agree that if he's not back in, say, 15 minutes, we probably ought to get dressed and go hunt him up. He stopped moving, one hand holding the tiny grasshopper stove and the other a packet of coffee. What is it? Shut up. There's something outside, he whispered. She froze. Several minutes went by, during which they could hear only the steady percussion of the rain and the puffing wind. Nothing, I guess, he said finally. He grinned. You know, I just had a thought. Maybe our good guide's using this opportunity to show us city slickers out here in the swamp. Anybody can be deluded by a little bad weather and a rambling tall story. He set the grasshopper going and put a pot of water on it. Okay, cross it, he abruptly shouted. Come on in and get yourself warm. The coffee's boiling and we're not. There was no response. Below, agitated water lapped at the meager shore. Briscoe shrugged. Let him get soaked then, I swear. If he comes tumbling in here and drenches us. It was thunder, but dull thunder, not sharp and clean like the kind that walks the treetops, but a rich, rasping ululation that had nothing to do with electric charges. It sounded again on a rising inflection this time, and while it did not originate in the heavens, it came from a source almost as primal, a feral thunder. Watkins found herself turning upside down as she rose into the air. The flaming grasshopper stove tumbled past her and shot out the open tent flat. Lockers, radio, food, charts, bedrolls, all fell in a surreal stream past her. Her head was bent to her chest and her hands went out instinctively. Then she did a complete somersault, her hips falling past her head. Somewhere above her, Briscoe was yelling about his legs up at the other end of the tent. Aluminum tubing snapped like fresh popcorn around her. So, this is how a cat in a sack feels, she thought wildly. Then there was air and rain in her face. Seconds later, there was pain splitting her backside and racing up her spine as she hit the ground. Rolling over, she murmured weakly, Carrie? A voice was alternately screaming and cursing in the hazy distance. Legs and pain and guns all whipped up together in a verbal froth of anger and terror. Her mouth was full of mud. She started to lift up on her hands, then collapsed as an uneven tormentor jabbed a long needle into her coccyx. Oh, God! She lay on her side, her right arm under her. The screaming and demanding went on behind her. Her gaze turned towards the noise. At the same time, she became aware of a thick, rich stench, like creosote. Lightning danced in a night sky of gray crepe. Outlined in the light was the Thunderer. Occasionally, it would let out a querulous bellow, a rumble like a simmering volcano. It shook her, mostly inside. She thought a mite hysterically of the reported sightings of such legends as the Yeti and Bigfoot, describing a hairy man or man-like ape 8 or 9 feet tall. How silly and foolish people are, she thought chidingly. Even the greatest of imaginary horrors fail when measured against the real thing. What stood in the now faded discharge of energy and light was at least 17 feet high at the shoulder, and it stood in a hunched over position. Long arms dragged the ground, ending in great burl knuckles that backed steam shovel-sized paws, long white claws curved back into the palms. It was only remotely manlike, a grotesque hybrid of simian and gargoyle. It had ears like a bat's, vast black eyes, and a prognathous jaw from which protruded a pair of upcurving tusks like a warthog's. She glimpsed a short, twitching tail, bald as a rat's. The entire slowly heaving mass was covered with short, bristly hairs, sparse but evenly distributed. Between the hairs, the skin was composed of large scales like those of a tarpon. It was holding the collapsed tent in one paw. She started to crawl away, not yet thinking of retreating to the boat, but only to put distance between herself and that transcendentally hideous form. She also worked to ignore the steady sobbing that was coming from within the smashed shape of the tent. "Arr! It bellowed. Another hand, the size of their boat, came off the ground, closed over its companion, and squeezed. There was a last, mercifully short shriek from within the tent. Then silence, save for rain and wind. The creature appeared to be exerting great strength. Watkins imagined she could detect a faint glow emanating from between those tightly pressed paws. Thoughts of the size of those paws had reminded her of the boat. Thoughts of the boat reminded her of the guns lying within. As she painfully dragged herself through the muck, she considered poor Carrie's modest 30-30 and Crossett's ancient over and under. She struggled to her feet, one hand pressed tight over the fire in her lower back as though that would somehow ward off the agony. As she stood, another needle pierced her left ankle and she nearly fell. Broken? She couldn't tell. She might as well throw mud at the gigantus or use either of the guns, but there was something else. A tightly wrapped pack of gel-ignite charges for making soundings. If she could set a detonator in just one charge, place it where the monster might step nearby, it ought to discourage it, perhaps even kill it. She had no time to consider where the monster was and refused to consider what it might be doing with what remained of Carrie. All her energies, all her thoughts, were concentrated on reaching the boat. It appeared undisturbed, bobbing nervously in the fractured water. In the middle, beneath her seat, should be the small, reinforced locker holding the charges. She reached the bow and slipped. No doubt about it, she thought with an odd disinterest. Her ankle was definitely broken. She lay, breathing heavily, rain pelting her mud-streaked face. Her arms moved weakly on the wet grain. Have to get charges. Despite the rain, she inched forward. The earth grew wetter and slipperier beneath her. Must ignore the pain, she told herself. Pretend it doesn't exist. Refusing to accede to positive thinking, the pain grew worse. Her femur was a log in a fireplace burning evenly. She paused. Moisture covered her mouth. She licked her lips. Not water, thicker, pungent, familiar. She glanced downward. She was lying not in thin mud or a puddle of rain, but in thick oil. It must, she thought wildly, be a natural pool oozing to the surface. That meant a potentially huge field requiring little drilling. Just drop in the pumps and suck it out. The company would be pleased. The boat, the boat. She forced herself ahead. Hand, knee, hand, knee. Maybe it wouldn't notice her. A dim, slow-moving little lump in the darkness. Her head bumped something, the side of the boat. up now, she ordered herself. Hand grip, gunwale, other hand grip, pull, pull, damn it. Her head was over the side. Ahead, still secure beneath the center seat, was the small metal locker holding the charges. It was neatly latched and untouched. She started to pull herself into the boat. Something made her nose wrinkle. Creosote. They found the boat and the remnants of the tent a week later. The hurricane had spent its strength and petered out over Alabama. Damn shame, Hardin muttered, kneeling to pick up a battered, broken shape. This might have been the radio. Might, agreed his disconsolate companion. Weinberger had worked in styrene with both missing geologists. His eyes surveyed the storm-battered swamp, the bayou behind them, where an iron ring was still tied to a stump of cypress. It was all they found of the survey party's missing outboard. Nearby was a small pool of oil, a smudge on the earth. Stains showed it had recently been modestly larger. Shreds of clothing lay scattered around and within the stained soil. Looks like the storm tore the clothes right off their backs. Hardin had his hands on his hips and nudged the blackened fragments of polyester and nylon. 120 mile per winds do it, for sure. Looks like they found some oil, too. Afraid not, Sheriff. Weinberger eyed the stained earth and the bit of fluid remaining with an experienced gaze and indicated the traces of two similar pools nearby. They must have had it with them, though I'm damned if I can figure out why. That old geezer back upstream said they bought only gas from him. A glint of metal caught his eye, and he bent to recover an oil-stained lump of dull, gold-colored slag. It was about the size of a belt buckle. Wonder what this was? He chucked it aside and sighed. Oh, the oil. It's fresh, new. Hasn't come out of the ground. No, I'm afraid they didn't find anything at all. We continue with a story from the summer 2024 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Mr. Yellow by Christina Bauer. The lights of my prison cell flicker on, waking me up. My world is a simple cube that holds a cot, toilet, and sink. Everything's white. For years I screamed and wept about my situation. Now I've resigned myself to reality. Time to work. I slide out of bed and pad across the cold tile floor. It's an art form to wash up without looking in the sink's mirror. Some mornings I still catch a glimpse by mistake. Not good. My neat black hair is now a single matted dreadlock. Worry lines are etched onto my face. White scrubs hang loosely on my skeletal frame. Was it only 5 years ago I presented my research at Echo Academy, all bright-eyed and ready to change the universe? I press my eyes closed and summon up the memory. I stand at the podium in a black skirt suit, my heart beating at double speed. The world's brightest scientific minds are in the audience today, including future funding sources. All my years of research boiled down to this moment. I clear my throat. Multiple dimensions overlap our own. I press a button on the projector system. Behind me, an image appears on the main screen, a sleek silver helmet. This VR headset is attuned to my thought patterns. With it, I can experience the sixth dimension in a way my three-dimensional mind can comprehend. The audience is silent. I can't tell if they feel awe or fear. My insides twist with worry. The sixth dimension knows I can contact them. They created this monitor panel in our joined virtual reality. I click another button. A silver wall of switches now appears on screen. If our actions negatively affect their dimension, then a new switch appears on the panel. There are already a number of dials pertaining to the Boston EnviroDome. See that button for cloud cover? If I make a change in VR, it happens in our reality. I smile, soaking in this memory. As I shared more that day, I cared less if anyone in the audience became worried or impressed. It simply felt right to reveal my discoveries. How wrong I was. After the presentation, I was arrested and placed here, somewhere deep under the Boston EnviroDome. I eat, sleep, and use my VR invention to contact the sixth dimension. It's as depressing as it sounds. A small opening appears in the wall. A block of supplies falls through onto the floor. Inside there are fresh white scrubs for me to wear, a couple of protein bars, and one can of desiccated vegetables. I scan the letter atop the supplies and ignore everything else. Prisoner 672896, flip Boston Dome CO2, kill switch for 4 hours. In other words, I must use my VR helmet to access the shared control panel and turn off the city's CO2 scrubbers for a bit, most likely for maintenance. Sure, the government can do this in our reality, but something will inevitably go wrong, a power outage, lightning cracking the EnviroDome, you get the idea. If they don't like something, the sixth dimension knows how to be irritating. The door to my cell swings open, revealing a long hallway covered in white tile. Lights flicker on above me as I slog down the passage. It ends at another cube of a room, only this place holds one object only, my VR helmet. I set it atop my head. There's the familiar sting as sentient strands wiggle their way through my skull. 1 second, the world is dark. The next moment, I'm back in the same all-white room, only the wall to my left is now silver and covered with gauges and dials. I'm my regular and somewhat awful self, only without the helmet. A man stands nearby, Mr. Yellow. He's tall and lanky, with cocoa skin, a square jaw, and large brown eyes. His suit is a searing shade of neon butter. When it comes to living up to his name, this guy isn't kidding. Good morning, I state. Good morning, Mr. Yellow, he corrects. Do we have to do this again? Yes. For years, Mr. Yellow was pretty cool. It's amazing what information flows from us into the sixth dimension. For some reason, Ian Fleming's work made it through unscathed. Mr. Yellow and I used to share James Bond jokes. He even let me call him M. Those were better times. Mr. Yellow's gotten crabby. He refuses to acknowledge any pop culture references. I used to wonder about it, but what can I do if Mr. Yellow has his panties in a bunch? Suggest therapy? I clear my throat. Good morning, Mr. Yellow. I say his name with all the sing-song reverence of a 4-year-old. Let's just say my social skills are rusty. Good morning, Dr. Jordan. What are your orders today? Government wants me to flip the CO2 kill switch for 4 hours. Mr. Yellow gasps. There's nothing in your dimension, but in ours, you'll cause a chain reaction. All life will be destroyed. You can't. I narrow my eyes. The government's had me do this before. You never complained. It's different now. You need to tell them. I'm not sure they'll listen. Please, They hang on to every bloody word you say. Remember the day you whined about a headache? They sent you 12 different drugs in your morning delivery. Which is true. Mr. Yellow has a mind like a steel trap. You know their system, I point out. If they do this for you, what can you give them in exchange? For years, your handlers have desired the secrets for mass manufacturing quantum computers. I can implant that in your brain. This kind of thing has happened before. After the implant, I write out the details, help the government, and stay in the same damned cell. The more I think about it, the less I want to help my jailers again. I don't think so, I state. Those implants made me sick. Somehow Mr. Yellow guesses the real reason I won't make an exchange. You could also crank up the O2 levels in the Envirodome to maximum. Are you unhinged? If I do that, then one person lights a match and boom, it'll fry the entire place. I live under the Envirodome. Not sure exactly where, but that's not the point. Mr. Yellow sniffs. And what a lovely existence you enjoy. Set the O2 levels to maximum. It will leave my reality intact. Try again. I eye Mr. Yellow carefully. The fun-loving version would never help me escape. But this grouch? Maybe things are different now. I want out. Can you help me? Mr. Yellow's mouth thins to a determined line. That's not possible. Suddenly, the answer is clear. I gave up everything for my work. Long hours, no relationships, and when I shared the truth about my research, I lost my freedom. It's time to change my perspective. This CO2 kill switch isn't a problem. It's my salvation. If I destroy the sixth dimension, there's no reason to keep me here. I'm free. Best of all, no one here will know what I did. Discussion over. I approach the control panel and hit the kill switch. Seconds pass. Nothing happens. Want to see a magic trick? Mr. Yellow turns to face the far wall. 1 second, I can see his face. The next, it's only the back of his yellow suit. That's when I realize the truth. Mr. Yellow exists only in two dimensions. My mind short circuits. How? Mr. Yellow flips to face me once more. Did you think you're the only one with this technology? You're in two dimensions. That doesn't make sense. I'm a representation you can understand, and I've been watching you. I recall all the little changes in my only companion, from the cranky attitude to the fact that I must call him Mr. Yellow. You arrived about 2 months ago. Yes. What happened to my Mr. Yellow? It's better if we talk about you. What a disappointment you've become. My heart sinks. Guess my social skills aren't the only things lagging behind. How could I have been so stupid? I should have noticed Mr. Yellow was someone else, complete with a new agenda. You were given great knowledge, adds Mr. Yellow. We expected you to use it wisely. He raises what looks like a Polaroid photo of me in his left hand. Our dimensions affect each other in unintended ways. The image shows me, right where I am right now, standing in that white-tiled room with my VR helmet on. Mr. Yellow picks up a pair of scissors in his right hand. He's still holding the photo of me in his left. Panic zings through my system. If Mr. Yellow cuts a two-dimensional image of me in his world, I'll be sliced apart in mine. No, no, no! Goodbye, Doctor. Little by little, Mr. Yellow snips the picture in half. pain shoots through my waistline. There's the briefest sensation of falling over. White light flashes. For a moment, it's as if I'm back on stage at Echo Academy, showing off my VR helmet. The audience bursts into applause one last time. Everything turns black. We conclude with a poem from the summer 2024 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is I, Magician by Julie Eliopoulos. Magic is intuition, child. It is all feeling. Bring me the offering on the altar. Magic is in the spirit, in the breeze. Consider the priceless needling embroidery, the spells cast by tallow, by oil, by reed candlelight. Remember the wars, how the mystical armies scrambling in astral armor faced acrid curses from the log-swept soldiers. I wrote that history by the new moon, a papyrus oath with my ship-borne chirography, the flecks of my punctured blade. Here, take these rose-hip scented pages. They belong to wanderlust. Now go with me to make a petition on behalf of the poets. We need poets. Then to the sea to save people from anchors. Then to the town to rescue people from anvils. Everything of land, of water, is sacred. Later, when I cannot write, scribe for me. Break the seal. Go with me to the temple. There is music, music in the legend of it. The magic sings with its own design. Come, sit by me. We must hear another story. All my life I faced toils, a net from a fisher's trajectory. Flax squares liquored with lonely community, pickled with an austere inheritance, an awkward, humorless cloak. I lived through the poisoned year and slept on the parched shore of long resentments. Take my path. Follow me to the hypnotic forest, to the prophetic cave, and to the ethereal mountain. One night, I might appear in a dream, toothless and sweaty, bubbling, wailing. It is a warning. They are coming for us, for the magic, trying to wipe out our fire with their cold calculations. So learn this spell and say it well. Say it when they come to split you, drumming in the creative hour. I am an artist of balm and healing. I, magician, will survive this death and revive the path of mystery, of spirit. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.